had to lose a mind. If I had to touch feeling, I would lose.
Welcome to the April 2012 episode of the Virtual Memories Show. I'm your host, Gil Roth, and I'm in the midst of trade show season. In my day job, I'm the editor of a business magazine, so I've got to cover a bunch of conferences over the course of the year. For travel-related reasons, they tend to cluster around spring and fall. So last month was San Francisco, this month is Phoenix, next month is New York, June is Boston and maybe Philadelphia, and July is Quebec City. That sounds like a lot, but it's not like I'm George Clooney and up in the air. I'm like George Clooney in lots of ways, but that's you know, not one of them. I don't think travel's like a major hassle. It's really the flights and hotels that sometimes wear me down, but I still dig wandering around new cities or finding neat stuff in ones I've visited before. Plus, I've made lots of pals among our advertisers over the years, so I usually have people I could shoot the breeze with when I'm on the road. Last month's San Fran trip was an exception to the rule. I literally knew only one person at that trade show, and he worked for a competitor magazine. So that kind of limited the candor either of us could use in our conversation. Still, it was San Francisco, so I had a good time. I'd been there before, but only with coworkers. This time I was flying solo, so I had more freedom to go out and do the weird stuff that I like to do. The evening I landed, for example, I checked into my hotel, unpacked my bags, and just started taking a walk to the City Lights bookstore. I'd never been there, and it did my heart good to see a well-stocked literary bookstore with lots of customers on a Sunday evening. I'm weird like that. I was a little bummed that I couldn't find the only two books I was looking for, but that's my curse. I went through the same thing at Powell's in Portland a few years ago. Anyway, after the first day of the show, I took the subway out to the Castro, and I visited Union Made, this menswear store that I'd heard about from a few style bloggers. It was fantastic. It's a really wonderfully curated shop, great staff, awesome selection of casual wear. It also had this mind-blowing collection of Alden shoes and boots. And if I hadn't implemented an austerity program for myself this year, which I recently blew up by purchasing some microphones and a recorder for off-site interviews, I'm sure I'd have left there with an insane credit card bill. But, you know, man can't live on books and menswear alone. I also engaged in some fine dining while I was out there, including this wonderful meal at Chez Panisse in Berkeley. And at the end of the trip, I got to meet up with a pal from college and her husband. We had a great time catching up. This month's Phoenix trip won't afford me so many opportunities. I think I'm going to be at a golf resort the entire time I'm there, maybe with a side trip out to a Diamondbacks game one night.
I only have to do it. The results are always perfect. But that's all the news. Would you like to hear my voice? Sprinkle with emotion.
The music this episode is Nirvana's cover of Oh Me by the Meat Puppets. I've been in a bit of a depression-slash-anxiety cycle for the past month or so, and music like this just fits right in with that mood. I really have to start listening to something cheerier. I don't know why I've been in that sort of state. Maybe I was just uptight about delivering a super awesome new episode of the show.
Deep inside me.
This episode's guest is Mark Feltskog. Mark and I met at Hampshire College in the early 90s. We fell out of touch for years, largely because I'm an asshole, but he reached out to me in 2004. He sent me an email saying he'd been watching an episode of the Dave Chappelle Show and it reminded him of my comic sensibilities. I think it was the one about the blind black white supremacist, which made me pretty flattered. At the time, Mark was being treated for cancer, a melanoma. He made it through that experience and now has a clean bill of health. And now that I'm less of an asshole, we've stayed friends for years. I thought we should sit down in his home in the Bronx and talk about that diagnosis and the books that helped him through the darker times, and the role that literature has played throughout his life, and talk about the period in which he rode boxcars around the country. I hope you'll enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Now, my guest today is Mark Feltskog. He's a friend of mine from more than half my life ago now, actually 20 years we've known each other at Hampshire College. I promise I'll start bringing in people who I did not go to college with eventually as guests, but for the moment, this is my starting point. Mark and I are going to talk today about a particularly trying time in his life and maybe some of the books that kind of helped him get through that whole process. Mark, why don't you say hello?
Hello, and thanks for having me, Gil.
The subject today is, well, it's your cancer diagnosis from 2004. We hadn't been in touch at that point, and I remember you did get in touch with me shortly after, and we sort of rebuilt our relationship around then, and we've had a lot of good discussions about books since, but I don't think we ever really talked about what you went through at the time. If you could tell me about your diagnosis and your early experiences when you first learned you had cancer.
Sure. I, at that point, had been in New York. I moved here about a year previous to going into St. Luke's Roosevelt in February of 2004 to see a dermatologist. It was just a routine visit. I had a mole on my neck that I wanted to have removed for cosmetic reasons. And to make a long story short, they removed the mole and biopsied it and found out that it was a melanoma. Hmm. And so everything went from there.
Yeah. And what was the initial prognosis? I mean, how dangerous?
Well, it was hard to say because it was hard to, without a lot of imaging, which of course happened shortly thereafter, it was hard to say how far this had spread. All they knew was that this was a melanoma. So shortly thereafter, I went to Beth Israel for a bunch of imaging. And again, to make a long story short, they discovered that while it was subcutaneous, it had spread underneath the skin, which is very dangerous. Melanoma of the three skin cancers you can get is the most dangerous and aggressive. That it had spread into my lymph nodes, but only a couple. So that first surgery that I had was just to remove some tissue from my neck to see what had gone on here. Once they established that it hadn't spread far beneath the skin, I was put in touch with a surgical team, and they began planning the treatment. I guess the thing I want to say parenthetically about this is it was because of advances in imaging technology over the last 20 or 25 years that made it possible for this diagnosis to happen really quick and for the subsequent treatment to happen really quickly.
Yeah. Was there a sort of dark night of the soul?
Oh, many.
Okay, yeah, I assumed. But, yeah. You know, how dark did they get?
First of all, I realized right away that, again, I had just moved to New York, and I was in this New York City Teaching Fellows Program, so which involved pursuing a master's degree in education. And while academically that was somewhat less than demanding, it still required engagement from me, as did working with some extremely difficult and scary street kids in a school in the South Bronx. So what I decided right away was that I was going to listen to, you know, obviously follow all the orders my doctors gave me, because I have a way of being willful that it could get in the way of my well-being, especially in this instance, and to try and not let this interfere with my life to the greatest extent possible. So I tried to schedule most of my doctor's appointments around school and graduate school. For the first time in my life, went out and got a cell phone, so it was very easy to conduct all the business around my appointments. And I'm not going to tell you that I wasn't frightened, but I really believe that one of the ways to deal with this emotionally was to preserve the status quo to the greatest extent possible, and that's what I did.
Yeah. How do you develop that mindset, I guess, in general? Do you think there was a big contributor in the past? I wouldn't say there's a particular book or anything, but was there some, you know...
Yeah, good question.
Mindset that sort of got you.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really good question. And I think the mindset was, in retrospect, and, you know, the reason I say that's a good question is because I really hadn't thought about it much, and I still haven't. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, you know, I was 43 going on 44 years old, and unlike so many of my friends, my life didn't really have any direction at that point. So I had just come into this teaching career, and this was going to be it for me. I knew that. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't, how do I want to say this? I wanted to make sure that I got through this and that I established my teaching career so that on the other side of this, I would be able to make a comfortable living. So, and I guess as I say that, I realize that discloses the fact that I did see myself recovering from this and getting out to the other side of it. And I think that had a lot to do with the way my doctors were speaking to me, because they moved very quickly and aggressively. At the time I was working in the school, one of the school nurses sort of became my sounding board for this, and anytime I would tell her, here's what happens next, she would say, well, that's really good, because what this means is that they recognize that you have the strength and the stamina to survive all this, and that your prognosis is good, so they're going to move very quickly. And they did. You've seen what my neck looks like. I had a radical neck dissection within 10 weeks of being diagnosed. Then 10 weeks later, I had a thyroidectomy, because one of the things they found when they biopsied the tissue that they took away from my neck was that I'd had a fairly common form of papillary thyroid cancer that, in fact, many people may be carrying around.
Not the HPV.
Yeah, it's exactly right. It was a papilloma. And so I had to have a thyroidectomy. So they moved very quickly and very aggressively to treat me. And I inferred from that, in addition to talking to my friend, that my prognosis was quite good. So I tried to maintain a positive attitude, which is not, as you know, easy for me all the time, but I managed to do it.
You know, Harvey Pekar being one of your literary idols.
Well, certainly. It's interesting you say that, because, you know, you mentioned, you know, were there any books that, and the fact is that the American Splendor movie had come out the previous late summer, and I had been aware of Harvey, and I had actually read some American Splendor in the 80s and seen him on Letterman a couple times, but I really didn't realize how much he was sort of, as you say, a literary idol, but also how much he and I had in common in terms of our sort of view of the world and relational difficulties and all the kind of stuff that you see that comes out in his comics and his movie.
Well, certainly, you and I, something I should have mentioned in the introduction, you're about 10 years older than I am, but we were contemporaries at college. I was no Doogie Howser, so you're about 10 years older than me and started college, or, you know, returned to college that much later. Can you talk about that in terms of the decision to pursue higher ed at 28 or so?
Yeah, I was actually 31 when I started at Hampshire.
Oof. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I had grown up in an academic household. My father was a college professor and didn't do well in school for a variety of reasons and found school a fairly painful place, actually, as a kid. But I always loved to learn, and I always, as you know, loved to read. And as I worked my way through my 20s at a variety of fairly dismal, dead-end blue-collar jobs, I started to see two things. One was that my body wasn't going to be able to hold up much longer working 10 or 12 hours a day in warehouses, and two, that this was just stultifying for me. And so I took some courses. Actually, the very first college course I took was a welding class. Didn't want to jump in. Didn't want to make too much of a cognitive commitment.
The transition.
Right. And then I started taking humanities courses at the local community college and got high marks and was told by people there, look, you really should move on to and matriculate into a four-year program. And because, you know, while this is appropriate for now, you're not going to be very happy here for very long. So I started applying to colleges and got into a few and was hard-pressed to make a decision about it and settled on Hampshire for a couple of reasons. It most clearly resembled the high school I went to, and it was nearby, and I knew Amherst, and I thought, you know, just going back to school at age 31 is going to be enough of a cultural and social shock that I don't need to be in a new place where I have to find my way around and establish networks for the kind of basic things we need to do.
Right. Dorm life being tough enough.
Yeah, exactly. So I settled on Hampshire, and don't regret it. I got a really good education there. But that was because I was 31.
Yeah, again, you know? There's different times of our lives that we'd appreciate stuff differently. But what did your parents teach? You mentioned being an academic.
My father was a college English professor at the University of Wisconsin with specialty in 19th century American literature.
Do you rebel against that completely? Or
well, you know what I did at Hampshire, so sure.
Yeah.
I haven't pursued sort of Americanism as an academic study in any way.
You went the opposite way and went after the Soviet Union for a while.
Exactly. It's interesting. I see one of your questions has to do with Moby Dick. And, you know, one of the things that my father, of the many things that my father, when he wasn't being abusive, would try to force down my throat was things like classical music. And Moby Dick was the big one. I still remember back in the late 60s and early 70s, really up until the VCR came along, the University of Wisconsin had this network of film societies because it was the university is still known as a good undergraduate film and television studies programs. I'd say parenthetically that, for example, when studios are looking to give away archives, they often end up at the University of Wisconsin. They have everything related to the television show Mannix, for example. I thought you'd appreciate that. All the scripts, all the masters and everything. So, you know, my father also taught a course on the detective novel. And you know how much I love detective novels, so obviously my rebellion only extends so far.
Well, which also raises the question of what you were reading when you were going through your diagnosis and your down times. And I, again, my thesis, as I mentioned before we turned on the recorder, was you're probably enjoying some trash detective fiction, as you call it, more so than, you know, Montaigne and the Stoics and things of that ilk.
Absolutely. And this is a literary podcast, obviously, and so it's nice that it always comes back around to this, because in our...
It's all I really have to talk about.
Well, we live in a benighted age as far as great literature is concerned. I mean, you know, you just notice that I'm reading Franzen. You know, Franzen is being put forward as, you know, sort of the great American novelist of the moment, in the vein of Fitzgerald. And he may be, but it's five books in. It may be a little premature to assess him that way. I don't know. But the fact is that we live in a culturally benighted age, and nobody takes much of this seriously. So I guess what I'm saying is it's nice to have a podcast where people are talking about books and ideas.
Well, I think beyond it being a benighted age for writing, it's a terrible age for reading, which, again, is my weird, not exactly Buckley-esque, you know, standing athwart, you know, the waves thing. That's just one of those ideas of, wow, it'd be nice if people could talk about books and what they're reading instead of, you know, tweeting and you know, which I engage in my time also. But, you know, having some way of talking about what we read, what it says about us, and not even whether it's, you know, therapeutic by any means, but, you know, who we are in relation to what we read is sort of what I care about. So.
Right.
And you found yourself with detective novels?
Actually, you know, I was reading a lot of comedy at the time. I went out and picked up both the American Splendor collections, and then my friend Karen sent me, I hadn't realized that they'd even turned it into a book, the thing that Harvey and Joyce did together,
Our Cancer Year.
Yeah. I read that. I reread a book that I read in the early 80s by a British author named Tom Sharp. That's with an E. Yeah. The name of the book is Wilt. And it concerns a character named Henry Wilt, who teaches English to technical school students. And it's, you know, you want to talk about a book that I returned to and loved as much this first time. It was that. I went out and bought one of the Peter Bagg, Buddy Bradley omnibuses, because, you know, I remember those. You directed me to those when we were at Hampshire. And those are, you know, endlessly funny. And I also watched a lot of fairly dumb comedies on video. So, you know, there was a Blockbuster. I was living in Harlem at the time, and there was still a Blockbuster on 125th Street. And I would go down there every night and come back with two or three Chris Rock stand-up performances or, you know, Spike Lee's The Kings of Comedy. You know, a lot of that kind of stuff.
Do you have any other touchstone-type stuff besides Wilt? Anything you find yourself returning to?
Is there a book that I keep returning to? You know, I did a lot more of that when I was a little kid. I remember when the first version of first film version of True Grit came out. I read True Grit probably four or five times between the time that movie came out and age 14 or 15. Wow. There was a book called Papillon.
I know the movie. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, by Henri Charrière. It was made into a movie with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman. In middle school, I probably read that book four or five times. And then there was a follow-up to it called Bonko that I didn't read. I maybe read that twice, and then I later on, probably into the mid-70s, after Charrière died, I read that these books might have been...
A little fictive.
A little fictive, yeah.
But convincing.
Convincing enough, and certainly, you know, when you're 12 or 13, you're not exactly looking for veracity. You know?
And we didn't have fact-checking Google back then.
All that, too. You know, I always come back to The Four Quartets by T.S. Eliot.
Oh, okay.
I love that. Howl is a touchstone. You know, I know that one of the themes you've been pursuing here is a book that you...
Once
didn't
detested,
like,
but and, came back
yeah,
to.
And I haven't had that experience, but one of my touchstones, I had the opposite experience with, which was The Town and the City by Kerouac. I commented in your blog about this. I started reading that book in 1981 or two and read about two-thirds of it and had to take it back to the library intending to get back to it. Well, I got back to it 3 or 4 years later, read 100 pages, and thought, how could I have ever liked this? This is... overwritten, precious, you know.
I'm afraid Kerouac is this big hole for me. I think I came to him too late, although I tried reading him during college once, which should be the optimal age, but right. it just didn't hit for me. And I tried again 2 years ago and or last year and thought, I'm just not getting it. Maybe I'm an old man. Maybe I'm a square. I don't know. But
I guess I agree with you, Gil. I read On the Road at 15. And then I read the other ones all, especially the Dharma Bums, the Subterranean, sort of the big ones, up until I read all of those before I graduated from high school. And I think I read the Dharma Bums a second time in my early 20s. And that's one of the better ones, mainly because all of his books are romans à clé, as I think you probably yeah. know. And this one is when he's in San Francisco and he's in the San Francisco beat community. So it's he's dealing with people, really interesting people like Philip Whalen and Gary Snyder. The Jaffe Ryder character in the Dharma Bums is very clearly meant to be the poet Gary Snyder.
Okay.
But again, you know what Truman Capote said about Kerouac?
No, no.
That's not writing, it's typing.
Oh. Now, let me ask you, do you have a stage of your pre-college history that would seem to have spun out of the Kerouac? You did ride the rails at some
did.
Point,
yeah.
and that seems to, again, come, at least to me, it comes out as a sort of romanticized beat thing.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I took my first cross-country hitchhiking trip when I was 17, and hitchhiked to Seattle. And I was with a woman I knew from high school. She was a couple years older, and she was going there. Actually, we went to Olympia. She was going there, you'll like this, to see someone at Evergreen, which is the West Coast version of Hampshire, as I'm yeah. sure you know. And I dropped her off and then spent the rest of the summer hitchhiking around. I picked strawberries. I did some other farm work. And I was on the road that time about 7 weeks. And I went back to Madison, finished my senior year of high school. And then for the next 3 years, I was on the road. My home base was around Brattleboro, Vermont, and I did a lot of apple orchard work in that area. That's how I really funded these trips. I'd go pick apples and make $1,500 or $2,000, and in 1978, 79, and 80, that was enough to keep you going for a few months, especially if you went somewhere like Ecuador, where your dollar went yeah. real far. I did ride freights one summer all over the West. I begin to wonder if you can even do that anymore.
Is it legal
well,
travel?
At the time, the story always was along the Burlington Northern Line, which is the main line between Minneapolis and Seattle. They have two branches. One runs across North Dakota in northern Montana. The other one runs across South Dakota through Wyoming, but they both end up in Seattle. And the story at the time was that you could... that the man who started the Burlington Northern Line had left some sort of codicil in his will or in the corporate bylaws that said that anybody could ride on empty boxcars anytime they want.
All the way to the big Rock Candy Mountains.
Right, exactly, where the bluebird sings to the lemonade yeah, springs, yeah. right? Yeah, and I certainly in my time doing that found no evidence to contradict that idea. The yard bulls, the yeah. security guys were always friendly. Always helpful. The very first time I hopped a freight, I was in Minneapolis at the main yard, and I was trying to figure out how to do this, and I see this guy coming across, it's this massive freight yard, 16 tracks, and I'm sort of right in the middle, and he's coming across in a big hurry, and I think, okay, well, this isn't
going to wherever he's going.
Right. And he says, what do you want? And I said, I'm trying to get to Seattle. And he points at a train and says, this one right here, be leaving in about 45 minutes. It's a hot shot. It's going to go fast. You'll be out in Seattle in a day and a half.
See, I'm telling you, I'm terrified when I'm at Grand Central or
yeah.
at the PATH yeah. station. I don't know which way I'm going. So, you showed a lot more faith than I would. In
well, and I hopped on the train in the next morning when I, let me tell you, if you think you're going to sleep in an empty boxcar, I mean, they're just really loud.
Is there standard bales of hay for you to lie on like we see in all the movies?
It was just an empty boxcar. And the next morning I got up and, as I'm going across, as I look out the door of the boxcar, I see North Dakota license plates. So, obviously, I'm headed in the right direction. And I had one experience after another like that. One day in Minot, I got off the train, and a couple of the yard workers with the security man stop, and they tell me to get in the truck, and I think, okay, they're going to turn me over to the police. And, I'm 17. There's only so much trouble I'm going to be in. I had a notarized letter from my mother that said I had permission to be doing this.
That is absolutely awesome. given that now it's I let my 10-year-old ride on the subway and I'm
right.
going to be vilified, that,
right.
That's much, much more awesome to
well,
have.
Well, I think she knew that if she didn't do that, I would do it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
A note from my mother.
Right. Well, and I had to produce it on more than one occasion.
Wow.
So I'm thinking these guys are going to turn me over to the police. Well, they take me to the workers' locker room, buy me a can of stew out of the vending machine and a soda and let me take a shot. I mean, I had one experience after
just
another.
A whole support network of guys writing. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Did books matter to you during that period particularly?
Well, of course. I probably was reading something. I mean, I've been reading a book a week since I was about 12 years old.
Great.
I mean, I can't think of, or even maybe even before that. I mean, I read all those Hardy Boys books, and of course, by 12, I was already into Charrière. And I think my friend Tom and I read The Last of the Mohicans. I mean, we fancied ourselves sophisticated readers.
Yeah. Yeah. You weren't coming from, like I did, you're coming from a small town with a smallish library. It sounds like you're coming from a more established base where,
and
you know.
Of course, my dad got desk copies of everything he taught, so that stuff was always around the house. Okay. And you know, I grew up in very bookish circumstances, to be sure.
So how does that play out now? I mean, tell me a little about the day job, or tell the listeners about the day job.
Sure. I'm a special education teacher in New York City. I've been doing this for 9 years, and I do read a lot of material for professional development, you know, how to plan instruction, how to meet the needs of struggling learners, how to meet the needs of diverse learners. I read a lot of theory behind education. I read a lot on discipline, because I work with kids who have serious discipline problems. And the way it works out now is that I work with kids who don't necessarily want to learn when I'm supposed to be teaching them, but nonetheless have a lot of really good questions to ask. And the fact is that my reading life has given me a fund of knowledge that there's not too many questions I can't answer at this point. And I think the kids that I work with like using me as a resource that way. And what I'm really interested in doing with them, look, I can relate with not liking school. I don't have any problem with that. Schools are institutions, and like every institution, there's a huge amount of dysfunction there. What I can't relate with is not being curious and not wanting to read and learn things. And I obviously, these kids are what various people are now calling digital natives, right? These are kids who grew up with all this digital technology. I thank God I didn't. I'm really glad that I didn't have the distraction of video games. I might have fallen into that and not become the person that I am. So I think the way it plays out is that I really encourage these kids, look, I understand you don't like school. I don't necessarily like school either. I understand the problems here. What I don't understand is why you guys aren't interested in anything, you know, other than what I would call fairly trivial pursuits, video games, you know, Facebook, Twitter, you know.
I mean, there's always that notion of the social, even without special ed kids, you know, it's the social life aspect of high school dominate, which is why I was a bookish nerd. And again, as we were talking about Hampshire over lunch, there was a Facebook group about our era at Hampshire where people are relating all of these anecdotes about the crazy indie music scene that apparently overlapped with our time there, of which I know nothing because I was spending most of my time sitting around reading or trying to get girls. that's part of our thing.
That's a college thing.
It's a time and a place for everything, and that's college.
That's right.
But yeah, apparently, again, even at a relatively small school like Hampshire, there's a much larger universe that I had no participation in because, again, I spend most of my time. As you may remember from the dorm administration people, they freaked out when I was accumulating bookshelves at a pace that, you know, seems like it would turn into some sort of community or South Park, you know, plot where I was just grabbing all those little two-tier bookshelves and building an entire dorm room out of them because I had too many books even back then. But
I don't remember that.
They wanted to fine me for the books.
Right?
I said, no, you fine people for missing bookcases. You should be paying me for having all the ones that are missing.
Making sure that these aren't disappearing when people put them in the lounge.
Right. You know, I actually stored them all up and had 8 to 10 of them, you know, completely loaded because, as usual, I felt that accumulating books was better than, well, it was a close second to actually reading them. If I had them on the shelf, at least that meant either an intention to read or at least an intention to keep people from asking me about them because they would be afraid I would, you know, unleash this unholy library on them. But
I think the other thing it did, Gil, and I think it's, I guess knowing you as I do, I think this is the same thing that it's done for you on some level, although you because you're more of a digital native, so to speak, than I am, are a little more comfortable. It really created in me a lifelong disdain for superficiality, which is one of the reasons why I just decided Facebook and all that just wasn't for me.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Because it just, to me, if you're going to engage in something, you really should engage in it. And I think I got that ethic from reading books. I almost never put a book down. Yeah. Almost never. And I've read some books that I really disliked. Well, we talked about Faulkner. Yeah. I wouldn't say I disliked Faulkner, but man, is this really going to reward? Is this effort going to be rewarded?
It's a lot of work, you know? And you feel like you're cutting through a wilderness. Yeah.
But I stuck with it because that's what you do.
Yeah.
You know, in life, I guess.
Yeah. And most people don't, which is again why we're recording, you know, hour long conversations about books and cancer that conceivably we'll have a couple of listeners for. But, actually, one of the other question, the one that I'd written down about that refers to Moby Dick, I had the question, and it's something I would ask myself if I was in your state back then. If I was worried I was going to die, is there some book that I either regretted not having read or, you know, would have gone out and started right away to know that I'd read it, a la Moby Dick in the movie Zelig, when his whole chameleon-like personality begins because he didn't actually read Moby Dick and has to pretend he did so he can fit into the conversation.
That's right.
Did you have anything when you were worried? Was there any sort of, you know, I always told myself I was going to read X before I died?
Interestingly, one of them was a book we've been talking about on and off all day, which was Poe, Dance of the Music of Time. That was one. Proust came to mind. Certainly Moby Dick to a certain extent, even though I'm still sort of acting out my Oedipal rebellion against Moby Dick. And I, as I understand it, I read Billy Budd a few years ago, and, you know, Melville's style is extremely turgid.
Oh, it's,
you know, and
it's something.
Yeah. And let's not forget that Moby Dick really fell out of favor for almost 100 years. It really wasn't revived.
It was unloved until the 20s and 30s.
But. Yeah, and Melville died. I mean, he was a customs inspector, I believe, in the New York port, and he's buried right over here in Woodlawn, by the way. He died not having been a very successful author.
No, I mean, he was best known for, you know, things like O Mu and Typee, more of the adventure seafaring novels.
But. And I think that I, on some level, had regretted... Had wished that I'd read Ulysses, I suppose.
Since recovering, though, have you pursued any of those?
I haven't. I have a copy of Ulysses here. I assume that eventually I'll be compelled to buy something along the lines of a Kindle, and I would read Powell on that. Okay. Proust, I probably ought to get to. You know what I remember most at the time, Gil, is I wasn't, and this really is what getting a cancer diagnosis or for anybody who's had a diagnosis of any kind of fatal illness, it really, for me, changed me from there's no other way I can think of to say it at the moment, is it changed me from a glass half empty to a glass half full kind of guy, almost instantly. And the thing I remember very distinctly about the time, especially when the diagnosis was still sort of in play and uncertain, right before that first major surgery, was I remember just feeling so glad that I'd had a chance to live here in New York City before the end of my life. Because I just, you know, when I moved here, I'd planned to stay here for a couple of years, and I sort of had this vision that this would be 2 years that I would suffer through, and then I would get my teaching license and my master's degree in education and move to Vermont and you know, live the life of a rustic, right?
Or post-Hampshire hippie,
right.
Whatever.
Whatever it is, right? Some sort of rustic in any case. And after I was here about 6 months, I remember vividly, I was in the village one mid-afternoon in early October, and it was one of those, you know what the light looks like in the city in the fall.
Well, it was that Bob Dylan cover where, you know, you're walking down the street.
Exactly. It was one of those gorgeous days, and there was a street fair on Bleecker Street west of 6, where it sort of turns and starts to head back north again. And that light was shining, and there was all this wonderful food and music, and I just thought, I am never, ever leaving this place. This is the most civilized place on earth.
And what brought you to New York? I mean, beyond the potential for the teaching fellowship, culturally, you know, what did New York mean to you before you got here?
Interesting that you'd question. At that point, what it meant to me was someplace I came when I was 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, living in Vermont, to sort of do the things that 18, 19, 20, and 21-year-old...
And a particularly weird era for New York, a particularly sordid era for New York.
It was really weird. Yeah. I mean, you know, I remember a few years later, I was talking to someone else about this yesterday. Somebody that I knew in Madison, I had moved back to Madison in 1881, and she was getting ready to move here, and I said, where are you going to live? And she said, Tribeca. This would have been probably in the summer of 81, and I said, where's Tribeca? Because it really wasn't, it isn't.
Neighborhoods weren't right. as
yeah. You say Tribeca now, everybody instantly knows what you're talking about. Yeah. It's just, for one thing, it's the center of the New York City film industry. And she described it, and I said, that, you mean that kind of crummy area down there where all the, you know, below Canal Street, where all those empty buildings are? That area was virtually abandoned.
A friend of mine still lives there, and she clearly had moved in in the cheaper days and has a phenomenal place now that's
one of those places are a fortune now. Yeah. And the Lower East Side was virtually abandoned. There were junk cars on the streets. It was very strange. So to me, when I came here, what it represented was kind of, I hesitate to say den of iniquity, but it was where I came to party when I lived in Vermont. Because what was there to do in Vermont? Go to the Common Ground and have a brown rice burrito. You know, I mean, it wasn't set up. I would come down here to go to Irving Plaza and hear music. I would come down here to see, I had a girlfriend here for a while. But when I came here in 2003, it was for a very specific reason, which was to get this credential and get a career going. Because, you know, up until that point, I had gone back to work for a wholesale company that I was working for in Wisconsin, merchandising stores, basically going around and setting up convenience stores. And needless to say, that was far from intellectually fulfilling.
Right. Yeah. Not really something you could fall back on the Hampshire education.
So, and now what this place means to me is I assume I'll be here the rest of my life, you know.
Bennett, it's your birth. I can't.
And that was the Virtual Memories Show. My thanks go out to Mark Feltzkog for opening his home to me and my microphones. You can find more episodes of the show at chimeraobscura.com/VM. It'll be carried on iTunes soon, so you'll be able to subscribe there. I promise. See you next episode.